I thought the police officers, I thought they were just so, they were heroes, supermen, you know. I just believed that because that's what I was taught.
When he was growing up in the suburbs of Wilmington, Delaware, in the 70s and 80s, Chester Holman III dreamed of becoming a cop. By the time Chester had reached his 20s, he was working as an armored car driver while studying criminal justice in Philadelphia. He was on his way to achieving his dream.
I just wanted to be somewhere in law enforcement. I wanted to be, you know, Secret Service, police officer. I just wanted to be something in that arena where I could, like, just protect and help people. And that's what I was drawn to.
Police have now identified a Penn student who was murdered early this morning. They say 24-year-old Tae Young Ho, a student from South Korea, was walking a friend home at around 1 a.m. At 22nd and Chestnut, two robbers came up to the student and demanded money. When he refused, they shot him in the chest.
Witnesses described seeing two black men, one in red shorts, the other in a blue sweatshirt, commit the crime and drive off in a white Chevy Blazer. Chester, who is black, was driving not too far from where this fatal shooting had happened. He was on his way to Southwest Philly. It was summertime, August 20th, 1991, to be exact, and late at night. He was with his friend, Deirdre Jones, and it was only the two of them in the car, a white Chevy Blazer. Chester was wearing green pants at the time, not red shorts or a blue hoodie. Still, the police stopped them and took them both in for questioning.
I mean, it happened so fast. I went from driving down Lombard Street to, next thing you know, 2 hours later, I was in a prison. I said, man, this is going to ruin my career.
Chester believed he'd be acquitted, even as he spent 2 years in jail awaiting trial. But even with the support of his parents and a team of attorneys, he was convicted of a murder he did not commit and sentenced to life in prison in 1993.
Prior to this, I never would have believed that any of this stuff is possible.
Chester's friend, Deirdre Jones, did end up testifying that he was involved with the shooting. Years later, she recanted and said the detectives had coerced her, threatening to charge her in connection with the murder, and claiming Chester had already admitted his involvement. A second witness who testified also recanted and said the detectives had coerced his account, using criminal charges pending against him as leverage.
Those detectives, you know, just sat there and just blatantly lied. You know, they came in that room and they just lied.
This is Obscured, the podcast from Kuvenda Media about critical issues that don't get much attention because they're complex, overshadowed, and happen largely out of the public eye. I'm Emily Previty. On this episode, we look at the impact of law enforcement trauma on people who've been exonerated. We'll talk to Chester Holman III, one of more than 40 wrongfully incarcerated people freed in Philadelphia in recent years after the district attorney's office reviewed their cases. Since then, Chester's been working to help others who were wrongfully convicted get out of prison and then start rebuilding their lives as he continues to do the same. Chester and other survivors, researchers, advocates, anyone who's looked at this issue really, will tell you accountability is all too rare, even for wrongful convictions where the institutions involved have basically admitted their errors, at least to an extent. Other forms of support are scattershot, varying widely from case to case, from state to state. Reforms are needed, and they're slow to arrive.
All through my 20s and my 30s, you know, I just had this zest for life. Even though I was incarcerated, I still had this, my adrenaline was always gone, and as time went on, I watched years just pass by and turn into decades. I just started seeing less and less hope. You know, I wasn't drained of it, but each year it was just like I just lost a little bit more. And I think maybe I was going to my 25th or 26th year, I think it was. And I just started telling myself that unless someone comes and really looks at this case, and at the time, it just wasn't there. And I just started preparing myself. And every day it was just like, this is where I'm going to die.
Throughout his time in prison, Chester kept writing to attorneys and organizations dedicated to overturning wrongful convictions to try to get someone to take his case. He tried representing himself. His family was working on the outside, too. Years went by. Key witnesses recanted, as we said earlier. Then the Pennsylvania Innocence Project accepted Chester's case in 2013. And in 2018, a significant break in the case— Chester's team got a hold of law enforcement files from the Philadelphia prosecutor's office showing evidence had been withheld during his original trial. That ultimately helped him to get a new trial. And eventually, 26 years after his conviction, the charges against him were dismissed.
On the way home from the prison, we stopped at, I think it was McDonald's or Burger King. Anyway, it was a fast food restaurant. And I went into the bathroom. I used the bathroom, and then I'm looking for the thing that flushed the toilet, and I couldn't find it. And I'm touching this urinal. I'm squeezing underneath the bottom, and, I'm just touching this nasty urinal, trying to look for a button, like it was a secret button or something. And then my uncle came in, and he was on the other side of the wall, and he just said, walk away. And then when I backed up, the thing flushed. And I said to myself, as I'm back, and I just started crying in the bathroom, I said, if I can't flush a toilet out here, how am I going to survive if I can't flush the toilet?
Chester had been incarcerated since 1991. That was long before most people even had internet access, dial-up, let alone Wi-Fi or smartphones or social media. So many innovations that were unheard of back in the 90s had become ubiquitous.
My mind was, it just wasn't prepared.
Chester was not prepared in part because people serving life sentences don't get access to the same resources and supports as those who might get out at some point.
They really considered you to be the walking dead. And it wasn't much given to us because you're never going home. So why put all my energy into this?
Now, Chester was home and wanted and needed to get his life going. But he didn't find much in the way of support specifically for people who'd been exonerated.
After I finally came home, I was just like, what do I do now? I just spent years preparing myself every minute of the day to die in prison. How do I flip that? I just couldn't handle it.
Nearly all reentry support is intertwined with probation and parole, and people generally are not involved in that if they've been exonerated. So Chester, who never committed a crime, was left out.
My attorneys found me a social worker and a psychologist and a psychiatrist, and I've been seeing them ever since. The first 2 years, I was just in a bad place. I had so many fears, nightmares. I was putting on the face. I was just scared and lost. And then last year, I just reached a point where it's like I just didn't want to be here anymore. I ended up at a place in Florida, a facility that handles PTSD, and, I didn't want to go. I fought it, but I ended up going down there, and I spent, they wanted me to stay 90 days, and I ended up staying 30 days, but I got so much out of that 30 days. It was right before Christmas, and I had already missed 28 Christmases. And I'd only been home two. I just couldn't do it, so I came home right before Christmas.
Multiple studies have documented that about half of exonerated individuals exhibit post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms. It's actually not much lower for all people who are or have been incarcerated. By comparison, that's more prevalent than what's been reported among combat veterans. The Exoneree Health and Life Experiences, or EXHALE, study came out in 2022 after researchers surveyed dozens of people who were wrongfully convicted and now are out of prison. They found that even higher than the rate of PTSD is the incidence of witnessing or experiencing traumatic events while incarcerated. Most of them experienced physical violence directly or vicariously. A significant proportion, more than 40%, witnessed someone die suddenly and unexpectedly, often violently.
I was there less than a month, and we were in the phone room. I was talking to my mom on the collect phone. And they came in and they stabbed this guy and they cut this guy up right next to me. And I just like melted into the wall because this is my first time ever seeing anything like this up close. And my mom is talking. And I'm telling her, I'm like, Mom, stop. I said, they're trying to kill this guy. And she's telling me, leave the room. And I'm like, I can't. And I'm watching this and this guy is just like, just getting cut and stabbed everywhere. You know, and I was just like, man, this cannot be me.
Chester told me he avoided direct physical violence almost entirely. No altercations with any corrections officers and just one fight with another inmate. He said he managed that through constant vigilance, and that took a toll. He also told me that people doing life sentences relied on each other for support because, as we've said, the prison didn't provide that in a meaningful and effective way. there was a similar lack of support just after he got out, despite the fact that the exoneration itself would seem to indicate a systemic failure or multiple failures. Innocence organizations and other private groups try to fill in to the extent that they can.
There are not a lot of spaces where our clients can speak about the wrongfully convicted experience, especially the mental struggle that they're going through, yet their family members don't necessarily understand.
Blanca Castro is a reentry worker at the Pennsylvania Innocence Project. She runs a support group for exonerated individuals that Chester has attended since his release in 2019.
Sometimes there is a misconception that support group means group therapy. We do talk about emotions and the trauma that they've experienced pre and post release. However, I don't use any behavioral or like therapeutic interventions at all. I facilitate the conversations. So I'll have some people join once or twice, and then I think it just becomes like a conversation that they don't necessarily want to engage in every 2 weeks. People find it most helpful talking about things they feel like they can't talk to their family members or loved ones about.
The Exhale study looked at support groups, and the results were mixed. But the researcher said it's clear. Exonerated individuals need consistent, long-term support on multiple levels. That includes developing specific therapeutic interventions and expanding them, such as by setting up counseling for families of exonerees.
Family support in general has been an idea that we've talked about. I think it's just resource-wise not possible at this time. Other projects might be thinking about it. But I mean, social workers and reentry services in general is sort of like a new addition within the past like 5 years.
The Exhale researchers also said they believe the situation is more dire than their findings might indicate for multiple reasons. First, exonerees they surveyed had to be in a place to participate. In other words, they had to be physically and emotionally healthy enough to engage, in addition to having computer access. The researchers also predicted that exonerations will increase exponentially in the future, with increased attention on wrongful convictions. But the number for now is still relatively small, and you can see that in the sample size of these studies. Just 59 people were surveyed in the Exhale study, and that's the largest group to date, as far as the researchers are aware. As part of our podcast, we're letting you know about other podcasts that might be of interest. And I wanted to tell you about a new podcast called On Being Biracial. I've been working with Darylise Lyons and Malcolm Burnley, two biracial Philly-based journalists, for the past year to create this podcast. It explores the complexities of biracial experiences and identities in the United States. On Being Biracial features more than 30 guests, including renowned comedian and documentary filmmaker W. Kamau Bell, and many others. You can find On Being Biracial and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or at onbeingbiracial.com.
On Obscured, we're covering issues that intersect with politics, government, and accountability. And we wanted to let you know about another show that's diving into big ideas about civic life and democracy. It's called Future Hindsight and is hosted by Mila Atmos. This award-winning podcast features conversations with changemakers and civic innovators and ideas for how citizens like you can take action to change the status quo and stay engaged. Find new episodes of the show every Thursday at futurehindsight.com or wherever you listen to podcasts. Now, let's get back to Obscured.
I met Chester for the first time just before Thanksgiving in 2022, a few years after his release. He told me he was getting ready to host 24 people for the holiday at his house in Delaware. And he still made time to sit down with me in Center City, Philadelphia, just around the corner from the Pennsylvania Institutional Law Project. Chester's been working there as a legal assistant and reviewing letters from people who are incarcerated. He told me he knows some of the people writing in personally from his time in prison, and that he'd actually reached out to the organization himself back then when he was searching for someone to help with his case.
I love the job. I love the people there. I love the staff. I owe a lot to those who have helped me to get to where I am and receive justice that I was denied for so long.
One of those people is Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner. So far, more than 36 people have been exonerated during his administration, and he's been in office for 5 years. By comparison, there were just 24 exonerations during the 3 decades prior to his election. Coincidentally, the day before Chester and I met, Krasner and some of his backers had held a press conference to rally support, because as Krasner's second term got underway, Pennsylvania state lawmakers started investigating him and began impeachment proceedings. State Representative Rick Krajewski is a Democrat from Philadelphia.
This is not about the actual safety of Philadelphia. We know for years that Republicans have not made any kind of actual action on the things that would make Philadelphians safe. For folks that looked at the impeachment process and the report that they came out with, to me, that was more of an indictment on police accountability than our district attorney, right?
That's good.
The Republican state representatives who initiated the impeachment said they were responding to rising violence in Philadelphia and what they described as Krasner's failure to prosecute crimes. Republican state representative Martina White is from Northeast Philly.
We have authority and oversight over the district attorney in Philadelphia. He would deny that. And I'm really glad that our chamber took this issue up and was able to pass the impeachment of District Attorney Larry Krasner today.
At the time, the 2022 midterms were approaching, and going after a progressive prosecutor was one way to try to mobilize the Republican base, however unlikely their success in actually getting Krasner out of office. Since the election, there have been a couple of brief flutters of activity around this, but most people don't think there will be any practical effect. Similar efforts to oust progressive DAs elsewhere, such as in San Francisco, have been successful. And public discourse about law enforcement reform and accountability inevitably touches on political will, or lack thereof, and the potential consequences preventing politicians from taking action perceived as anti-law enforcement. All of this was at a crescendo around the time I first talked to Chester. Chester told me he's not so sure he'd even be out of prison if not for Krasner. So it had been hard to watch the coverage.
These people, either they do know or they don't want to know, or they do know and just don't care, or it's like whatever, you know, it's because it's not anyone that they know, it's not them, it's not their family, whatever. For people to look at that and say, like, he's too soft on crime, or, you know, his administration is allowing stuff to happen in the city because of what he's done, is like, I just don't understand. I mean, these people would rather me still be in prison than to right this wrong.
Chester didn't get an apology or a direct acknowledgement of wrongdoing from the law enforcement involved with his case. Some other city officials apologized. The city also paid him a $9.8 million settlement, one in a succession of payouts over police and prosecutorial misconduct.
I struggle with that because, you know, they're talking about millions of dollars, but I'm like, what's my life worth? You know, 28 years, what's my life worth? Are you, you know, is it 10 million, 50 million, 100 million? I mean, like, I'm saying my life is only worth this. And I'm like, for somebody that I love, I can never put a price on my mother's life. I can say, well, give me $100 million for my mother. It just wouldn't happen. Finally, when we reached the settlement that we did, you know, my lawyers were like, we think this is fair. What's the second size in the history of the city? I said, that's what you think. I said, that's fine. But my life is worth more than $9.8 million. I still wanted apologies from the city. I wanted somebody to acknowledge what had happened.
As insufficient as the accountability stemming from Chester's case seems to be, even that is also rare. It's difficult to sue the police, let alone win. UCLA law professor Joanna Schwartz exhaustively details the history, politics, case law, and more behind all of that in her book, Shielded, How the Police Became Untouchable. We interviewed Schwartz in a previous episode. Schwartz highlights potential solutions in her book. They aren't specific to exonerations, but the majority of U.S. states do attempt to address wrongful conviction with compensation statutes. At least that's the idea. These laws set up a way to access financial remedies without going through litigation. In some cases, other support, including housing, education, healthcare, etc., is available too. Of course, the devil is in the details. Dollar amounts vary widely between programs in different states, not to mention some of the more nuanced components. For example, Illinois and a few other states disqualify people from receiving any compensation through these programs if they pleaded guilty or confessed, even if it was shown they were coerced into doing so. These laws are not in place at all, though, in about a dozen states. That includes Montana, which recently let its program lapse completely, and Delaware, where Chester grew up and ultimately settled after he got out of prison, as well as Pennsylvania, where Chester was living and working and arrested in the 90s and then incarcerated for decades. State lawmakers in Pennsylvania have introduced bills that would establish compensation statutes with some regularity since 2003.
There have been at least 10 or 20 attempts since the early 2000s to do this.
John Rago is a law professor at Duquesne University near Pittsburgh. He was instrumental in a state legislative research report that resulted from a four-year deep dive into wrongful conviction and coming up with recommendations to address it in Pennsylvania. He's watched closely for years as lawmakers introduce bill after bill to establish compensation for wrongful conviction, and very little happens beyond that.
I don't think any of them, except the current one in the House, has ever even had a hearing. And many of them were introduced at a point in time in the legislative process. There wasn't enough time to get it through anyways. So was that a tactic or was it just, I don't know what that was.
The current one he's referring to is House Bill 1470. We'll put a link to the full bill text in the show notes, but here are a few highlights. 1470 sets out a payment schedule for people who were wrongfully convicted. $75,000 per year in prison, $100,000 a year if the person was on death row, $50,000 a year spent on probation or parole. All of the payments would be tax exempt, and the amounts would be adjusted for cost of living increases. The bill tasks the Pennsylvania State Supreme Court with developing the steps in the petition process itself, which the legislation explicitly says should be as informal as possible, so that people don't have to get an attorney. And if they do get a lawyer, those fees would be capped under this law. Tim Cloggs is the executive director of the PA House Judiciary Committee, which talked about the legislation at a hearing in October 2023.
This bill would provide services after release because they've got a lot of life to rebuild. A person is eligible for compensation when their conviction was reversed or vacated and when a full pardon was issued. This carries over to the heirs of a deceased individual. There is a six-year statute of limitations on these for people who are currently incarcerated. A two-year statute if a person was released before the effective date. Once the petition's filed, it goes to Commonwealth Court. The court has to forward a copy of the petition to the prosecutor, who gets to chime in.
Democrats gained control of the PA House after the 2022 midterms, so they have a majority of seats on this committee. The bill passing is just a step, but still further than prior similar legislation has moved, even with all the Republicans on the committee voting against it this time around. One of them is Rob Kaufman, who'd been the chair of this committee for the past 4 years while the GOP controlled the House. So it had been up to him which legislation the committee discussed and voted on.
There are areas for agreement on this issue. Unfortunately, I think this legislation goes a bit too far. Folks who are pardoning is not an expression of innocence. It's an expression of forgiveness.
Later, I asked the bill's sponsor, Representative Regina Young, about the possibility of eliminating eligibility for people who'd been pardoned without being exonerated or having a conviction overturned.
We reached out several times, and we have not been met with a meeting as of yet. So until we have that conversation, I'm not really sure what his expectations are.
Young didn't have anything to share when I asked about other possible changes or additions to the bill. She did tell me that it wasn't modeled after one particular state, but reflects best practices in a sense, with components that show up in these laws across multiple other states.
We were just trying to find a common denominator on what is passable, what makes sense across the entire nation. And so I will say we didn't consider one over the other. However, the neighboring states weighed in a lot more because they're closest to us.
Republicans have controlled the state Senate in Pennsylvania for decades.
Once we can change the composition of the Senate, then I'm confident we can get this legislation passed.
State Senator Art Haywood represents parts of Philly and Montgomery County. Haywood is a Democrat who's been in office since 2015, and he supported multiple versions of this legislation.
You know, it takes a long time to get legislation passed, but It also takes a while, obviously, to change the composition of the General Assembly.
In most states with these laws, they were enacted and amended while a single party controlled the state legislature and the governor's office.
There's always competing priorities. There's a cost to everything that we do. Right now, we got a $45 billion budget. So it's just a matter of what's a priority and what's not. Paying exonerees has not yet become a priority for the majority.
If all of these folks whose liberty was stolen were white people, this would have already been enacted into law.
I also talked to State Representative Chris Rabb, a Democrat who's represented Northwest Philadelphia for 6.5 years.
Probably the most central tenet of conservative leadership is defending our liberties. What is more essential to one's liberty than one's bodily autonomy to not be put in a cage? Wrongly, when you haven't done anything, but the presumption of guilt stains these exonerees because of their complexion.
Black people are much more likely to be wrongfully convicted than their white counterparts, according to a study released in 2022 by the National Registry of Exonerations in partnership with UC Irvine and the University of Michigan and Michigan State University law schools. The disparity is consistent across crimes, but it varies. 7 times as likely for murder, 19 times as likely for drug crimes, and so on.
This would not be an issue if these folks were white. At all. The vast majority of these people are poor black men with whom they do not identify, whose constituencies do not include a critical mass. That's the issue. It is not easy to say. I'm sure I could be attacked for calling my colleagues racist, but if the shoe fits, I don't know how else to say it.
It's unclear what will happen in the state house with wrongful conviction compensation. In the meantime, there is some movement at the local level on this issue. Philadelphia councilperson Isaiah Thomas recently introduced a couple pieces of legislation specifically aimed at supporting people who've been exonerated. His goal is to get it passed by the end of 2023 and start the program in the beginning of 2024.
When you hear the story of people who spent 18 years, 27 years in prison, it's heartbreaking, and the impact that that has on them as well as their families in their community, there's no way to measure how much of a negative impact these things have on our society in general.
One piece of legislation lays out language for city hiring rules, specifying that exoneration is not a disqualifier for certain city jobs that won't consider people within 7 years of a conviction. The other proposes a partnership between city agencies and private organizations to support exonerated individuals upon release with $500 in cash, help with housing and childcare, legal assistance, scholarships for classes at the Community College of Philadelphia, and more.
Right now, the way the system is set up, there's more resources for a person who is actually guilty and they transition out of incarceration than a person who is innocent and either been exonerated or been found as somebody who's been wrongfully convicted. When we recognize that problem, it's important that we create a bridge from their transition out of incarceration to their opportunity to be a productive member of society. That's the role of government, because government has the role of controlling the criminal justice system. And when the criminal justice system gets it wrong, I believe it's up to government to step in and step up and try to right that wrong to the best of their ability. Those folks will never get their lives back. And it's unfortunate that there's nothing we can do about that part. But the least we can do is for the remainder of their life, make sure that they have resources and opportunities to take care of themselves as well as their family.
Thomas says this local program is meant to provide immediate support, not to replace more robust compensation that can take years to materialize, whether that's through lawsuits or a state-level program meant to be an alternative to litigation. When I caught up with Chester recently, I told him we'd be covering the issue of compensation statutes and the lack thereof in Pennsylvania in the same episode as his story. The compensation statutes and for people who are wrongfully convicted. I mean, you pursued financial remedies through litigation, but you basically had to. People still choose to do that, but the fact that Pennsylvania doesn't have it is not.
Right. Not cool.
Chester's still working with the Law Project. He's also kept up his work with the Urban League, going inside prisons every week to help people prepare to leave and give them some advice and encouragement about restarting their lives. Even many months after he told me about the challenges of balancing his own need to heal and move forward with his passion for helping others do the same.
Emily, believe it or not, nothing's changed. Nothing's changed. I'm working more so with the Urban League than anything else, though. We're in the county prison, Philadelphia County Prisons, Monday, Tuesdays, and Thursdays. I think with the correction officers, naturally, they're seeing us on a daily basis. I think, you know, they begin to get a feel for who we are and so forth. Whereas police, it's that one time they lock you up, put you in the back of the car, and then you're done. Next time they see you, you're in court. So there's no real rapport built in that process, so.
Chester's been focused on supporting people after those interactions with the courts and law enforcement, and working toward wider change, even though it's often difficult, as he told me the first time we talked.
But this is a difficult fight, and this ain't no easy fight, you know? So I have to at least be sound in order to do that. And that's what I'm trying to do, so I, you know, can do more to help. At least bring awareness, if nothing else, you know? Because like I said, a lot of people don't even realize this thing is really real, you know? That these things happen. No, it does happen.
Next time on Obscured, health researcher Arturo Zinni talks with us about his work helping people cope with community violence. My colleague Stephanie Marudis and I interviewed Arturo on campus at Drexel University, where he's executive director of the Center for Nonviolence and Social Justice.
We work with people who, on average, have deep mistrust of organizations that they have interacted with. Hospital system, healthcare, educational, child welfare, sometimes juvenile justice, right? So they felt they've been underserved. A lot of times the services that they received were not culturally sensitive. They were not aware of the deep trauma that the communities have experienced, right? And how you want to engage with people who have gone through trauma, you know, honoring their voices.
In the meantime, for more about Obscured and the rest of our work, keep up with us on social at Kuvenda Media. Obscured's From Words to Weapons series is produced by Kuvenda Media and mixed by Brad Linder. Our series was edited by Diane Hodson and fact-checked by Chelsea Zhu. Malik Calhoun composed the music for this episode and the rest of our series. Eve Abrams provided additional editorial support for this episode. Special thanks to Jennifer Merrigan and Marissa Bluestein, and to our fiscal sponsor, Media Alliance, and Obscured's founding supporters. You can help more people discover Obscured by leaving us a review on your favorite podcast app and sharing it with others who might be interested. Stephanie Marudis is Kuvenda Media's executive producer and Obscured's co-creator. And I'm Emily Previty, executive editor and co-creator of Obscured. Thanks for listening.